In a time like none of us have experienced before, there's strength to be found in community institutions like Iowa Public Radio. I'm Executive Director Myrna Johnson, and I'm so proud of the thoughtful, informed coverage IPR brings you on the issues that matter. Listener funding is the power source that makes it all possible. Facts, understanding, insight, that's what you fund when you give to this station. Make your gift now at iowapublicradio.org, and thank you.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. We all want to be happy, right? Many of the choices we make in life are based on whether or not those choices will lead us to happiness. It's how we choose our careers, decide whether or not to take a certain job, make decisions about our relationships, or even decide whether or not we want to have kids. But what do we really know about what makes people happy? About what can make us happy? Happiness is actually a field of pretty intense study, and this hour I'm going to talk with two professors who've pulled together research from many different sources to give their students some guidance about how to pursue happiness with the best results. Benjamin Honeycutt is a professor in the Department of Health and Human Physiology at the University of Iowa, and he's teaching a course called Health for Happiness. He's also the author of The Age of Experiences, Harnessing Happiness to Build a New Economy. Ben, welcome back to the show.
Charity, good to hear your voice. Good to be by.
Well, thank you so much. Gary Goody is also here. He is Associate Professor of Applied Human Sciences at the University of Northern Iowa, and he's teaching a course called Foundations of Positive Psychology, the Science of Human Flourishing. He researches flow, or a state of mind in which a person becomes fully immersed in an activity. We will explore that more later in the hour. Gary, welcome. Gary, can you hear me?
Can you hear me now?
Yes, I can.
Welcome, there we go.
Welcome hey, Charity. To the show.
Oh, thank you so much. And hi, Ben.
And
hi, Gary. Again.
And Ben, I want to start with that word happiness, because I think it's a pretty slippery word. It's pretty hard to define. What makes it challenging to study something that's so amorphous?
Well, you're right. It is a word that a lot of people avoid. Psychologists especially, and Gary's using the word flourish, I think is a better word than happiness, because happiness carries so many maybe unfortunate connotations, sort of a mindless, carefree, you know, happy, happy, joy, joy, Ren and Stimpy, the cartoon characters.
Yeah.
But it's, again, the word we have, and so I make the best of it. But there's so much behind the concept of happiness that psychologists and other scientists, the new sciences of happiness, have sort of joined together, a consilience, jumping together of theories of positive neurobiology, psychology, economics, and my field history, to come up with some surprising new theories, new research, about what it is that makes for fulfilling a full life, for happiness, for thriving. That research has really taken off in the last 20 years. I made use of it in the book that we talked about, I believe, on the air.
Yeah.
Last year, about the age of experiences, the a new economy of experiences that are developing. So that science, when I wrote the book, I was thinking about applying the new sciences of happiness to the marketplace for experience design. Then it occurred to me that this is something that I could go directly to my students with and deliver these theories as well as some of the practices in a class. That's what I've tried to do. So it's my class is designed to review the new literature, the new sciences of happiness, a cross-discipline sort of thing, and then find ways to actually put these theories into practice in the everyday life, make it relevant to my students. So the biggest part of the class design for me was the assignments, finding ways to apply these theories in the lives of students.
And I think that one of the things that is useful about the word happiness is that when we hear the word happiness, we all know we want it. Gary, I know that you use some different words to try to get us to that concept of happiness, to try to be maybe more precise about it. What kind of language do you feel works best?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with both of you on this. Sometimes I think my course should be called The Trouble with Happiness. Because it is, as you say, Charity, so amorphous, and we all know that we want it. We have this hot passion for happiness. But the fact of the matter is, it is, just a second here, I've got a bad echo. It is something that eludes us. It's similar to the concept of creativity in some ways, which is my other research area. You know, people has a very positive connotation, but researchers need to define it, and we define it fairly narrowly, and not everybody is on board with that. And people talk about creativity as they will, based upon how they understand it, just in the general population. And the same thing is true with happiness. There's kind of a paradox, I guess, with happiness. On the one hand, we know that happiness takes work. I'm sure Ben will talk about this, and I can jump in as well. But much of the research over the last 20 years has made it very clear that happiness doesn't just happen to us. It does require work on our part to live a happy life. But on the other hand, we also know that you can't chase happiness. If you try to chase it, it's probably going to elude you. I'm reminded of Viktor Frankl's statement in his book. I think it's the introduction to A Man's Search for Meaning, when he talks about success. He says, the more you aim for it, the more you make it a target, the more you're going to miss it. So I think that trying to be happy, trying to chase happiness, is probably going to end up, you know, being frustrating for most of us. But there are ways of getting at it in kind of a roundabout way. And one is this concept of flow that, you know, we'll be talking about in a few minutes, I'm sure.
Right, absolutely. And so the more we chase happiness, the more we're going to miss the mark. But I mean, Ben, every student that signs up for your class is clearly looking for happiness. All of us are searching for happiness. So when you bring your students into the class, I mean, I know that you're going to give them an opportunity to learn about a lot of the research that has been done. But where do you start?
Oh, gosh, with my assignments, I try to take one aspect of the research that's been done, some of the empirical jumping together of theories from neurobiology and a variety of other fields, and create an assignment that would apply this research to a student's life. For example, mindfulness is one of the findings of the new sciences of happiness. The more that we're aware, the more we're mindful of what's happening around us and to us, the better our lives become. We become more skillful at living. Our lives become richer and fuller. One of the examples, one of the assignments that I just made for my class was savoring a meal. Pay attention to a meal. Be aware of the tastes and textures. Maybe even talk about the meal with. Maybe even watch one of Charity Nubby's Iowa ingredient programs and think about that food. Become present to the food. Be in the moment. Bring to the moment an awareness, an attention span. That will focus your experience, that mindfulness, again, trying to apply what psychologists have seen to be strong correlates with our well-being, with our happiness, with a positive subjective experiences, certainly, but also positive individual traits. So those are the two things that I'm aiming for in my class.
Well, it's interesting, Ben, that you mention getting more skillful at living. I was just listening to a conversation last week about the fact that people over the age of 50 tend to be happier than people who are under the age of 50. I am 46 years old, and I can tell you that I wouldn't go back to my 20s for anything. And I feel like I get happier with the passing decades. So you're working with students who haven't had a whole lot of practice at that. So do you feel like if you're in your 20s, you can harness some of that knowledge that, that maybe a lot of us get through decades of experience?
Well, I think you could point people in the right direction. And I think positive psychology and neurobiology and economics, the new sciences of happiness, have tried to do that, point people in the right direction, show them by example that there are a richer life out there, that richer possibilities for experiencing the world than cell phones and text messages and so forth that take away our attention from other people in the real world. And just point them in the right. And I try to do that in my class with these assignments. I have an assignment on thankfulness that's one of my favorite. Research shows that we are hardwired to concentrate on the things that go bad in our lives. One bad thing will ruin the day. But if you begin to be aware of and appreciate the good things, and so the assignment is over the next week or so, record at the end of the day three good things that went well that you're really excited about through the day. And pre and post test, I have them take a happiness test before and a happiness test afterwards. The idea is to become, the more you are aware of the good things and appreciate the good things, the better your frame of mind will be. And you can point again people in that direction. One class, and perhaps, most of the information will percolate out of the top of the heads of my students. I hope not, but maybe some will remain. And again, point people in the right direction with these assignments and with the things that we say.
Well, and I also don't want to imply that all people just get happier as they age. I know plenty of people struggle with that through the decades as well. And these sound like exercises that could probably benefit any of us. We are going to take a short break here. We'll be back in just a moment. This hour, we're talking about happiness, our pursuit of happiness, what science can tell us about what really makes people happy, and how to harness some of this knowledge in our own pursuit of happiness. You're welcome to join the conversation. You can call with your questions or your experiences. You can call 866-780-9100, tweet us at Iowa Public Radio, or send email to Iowa Public Radio or Talk of Iowa at iowapublicradio.org. I know that email address. With me this hour, Benjamin Honeycutt, professor in the Department of Health and Human Physiology at the University of Iowa. He's also the author of The Age of Experiences, Harnessing Happiness to Build a New Economy. Gary Goody is associate professor of applied human sciences at the University of Northern Iowa. He also studies flow, and you can find out a lot about his work at theflowchannel.com. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
If you love this podcast and IPR, you probably know that it's fueled by listener dollars. Hi, I'm Rick Brewer, a talk show producer at Iowa Public Radio. And part of my job is connecting with Iowans who have stories to tell. When you contribute to IPR, you help make that possible. Membership contributions make up 57% of IPR's budget. That's huge and amazing. So do your part to support the podcast and programs you enjoy. Go to iowapublicradio.org and tap the red donate button. Thank you.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we are talking about happiness, what science can teach us about pursuing happiness and what makes people actually happy. With me this hour, Benjamin Honeycutt. He is a professor in the Department of Health and Human Physiology at the University of Iowa. He's teaching a course called Health for Happiness. Gary Goody is also here, associate professor of applied human sciences at the University of Northern Iowa. He's teaching a course called Foundations of Positive Psychology, the Science of Human Flourishing. And you are welcome to join our conversation this hour. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. And Gary, when we talk to young people often, we talk to them about identifying their passion or pursuing their passion. In fact, we talk to people at many different points of their life about that. If somebody's looking to change their career, like maybe if we find the thing that we're passionate about and we can do that for a living, that's the key to happiness. You feel like that may be leading us in the wrong direction. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, thanks, Charity. I think it does. We it's finding your passion has become one of these compelling memes over the last several years. It's probably been there for a long time, but we hear of it all the time now. And people have bought into it and are very concerned about finding their passion or finding their purpose. And if they don't, they beat themselves up and feel miserable and, you know, feel that they're a failure. And I think that what that does, that mission of trying to find your purpose, just sets us up on it for a course for potential frustration. So I don't think that's the way to get there. I think that what that does is really has us chasing some abstraction. Instead, I think what you need to do is find something to do in your life, something that's meaningful, something that's engaging, something that gives you a sense of achievement. And from that, happiness can ensue, or at least a sense of well-being can ensue, can follow from that, rather than trying to put the pursuit of answering this question, what is my purpose first? You know, one thing I'll mention here, I'm sure Ben uses this a lot in his class as well, is that Martin Seligman, when he launched, along with Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, this field of positive psychology, Seligman has promoted what's called the PERMA model, which is a powerful theoretical framework for helping us understand flourishing and happiness. And that is that building a happy life or building a flourishing life consists of building positive emotion, positive engagement, positive relationships, positive meaning, and positive achievement. Now that gives us a framework that sort of takes this jungle of happiness and all as amorphous as it is, as we discussed earlier, and turns it into more of, I guess, sort of a park so we can kind of get a handle on it. But there are ways of getting at, I think, happiness as an outcome, or at least building meaning in one's life as an outcome. And, you know, this concept of flow that I work with is that we work with is certainly one of them.
Well, and it sounds like almost like you're saying, when we talk about finding our passion or finding our purpose, there's almost a certain amount of magical thinking that's involved in that, as if, you know, we only have one passion or one purpose that can lead us to happiness. But it sounds like you're saying that we don't have to find that sort of magic key.
I think that's a great way to put it, Charity. This idea of flow that I'll talk about here in a minute, we're trying to get people past this idea, once they know what flow is, to think of it as a state, but rather as a way of life. And by finding ways of building this into your life and multiple dimensions of your life, you're going to have a much more coherent, unified, integrated kind of a life, and hopefully a lot more happiness.
Ben, what do you want to add on that? Because, again, I'm sure that every student that walks into your classroom has gotten that advice from somebody in their life. Find your passion, find your purpose. And I think every person listening has probably gotten that advice from someone else. So what do you talk to your students about with regard to that?
Let me say a word or two in defense of finding your passion. I make use of Seligman and Peterson's Character, Strengths, and Virtues Handbook. They have put together the wisdom of the ages that they have, are claiming, along with Csikszentmihalyi, the wisdom of the ages have been empirically verified over the last 20 years, that the virtues that have been come down to us historically, the six main virtues, wisdom, courage, humanity, transcendence, justice, moderation. Yeah, each of those are broken down into character strengths, such as creativity and so forth. I have my students take the values and action survey to identify their signature strengths. Those things, those virtues, those character strengths that they excel in, creativity, forgiveness, transcendence, spirituality. Find those things that you're really good at and build on those things as building on those character strengths, the things that you're good at, strongly correlated with enjoying life, with enjoying ourselves, and becoming stronger and more adept at those signature strengths. Signature is one of my assignments. Identify the listeners can go to Seligman's webpage at Penn State Values and Actions VIA and take the survey themselves if they would like to. It's free, and identify character strengths. And I ask my class, my students, and perhaps some of the readers would be interested in readers, listeners would be interested in doing this. To find an activity over the next week or two that would build on your character strength, your signature strength, and report the success and whether or not you actually achieved a happier score on the test, the pre and post test that I asked my students to take. So I do believe that there's such a thing as signature strengths. Seligman at least does. One of the rewards, one of the best things we can do to flourish in our lives is to build on those signature strengths. We work on our the things that we're not very good at, and I share with my class my list of things I'm good and bad at. We work on those things that we're not terribly good at, but we enjoy giving expression to and finding new ways to employ those signature strengths. So let me say a word for signature strengths.
All right. Well, and I think that what I'm hearing you say, Ben, is that once you identify your strengths, then maybe that helps you find something that you can be both passionate about and good at. Is that kind of the element that you're looking for there?
Exactly. And part of the recipe for me is to broaden and build, to get better at it. That has one of the strong suggestions from positive psychology, going back to self-determination theory, Deci and Ryan, becoming more and more competent, more and more self-reliant, more and more autonomous, going in those directions, building those skills associated with competence, those skills associated with these character strengths, those signature strengths, becoming more competent, moving in that building, not standing still, moving under, finding new ways to broaden and build. Barbara Fredrickson at Chapel Hill, a wonderful psychologist that I follow quite passionately, broaden and build is her recipe for happiness. Get better, become more self-reliant, become more competent. That is, I think, one of the keys that at least one of the precepts that I'd like to teach.
Well, and it also sounds like there's a real journey of self-discovery there. And of course, you are teaching young people, but all people at all different ages sometimes suffer from really not knowing themselves particularly well. I think that is really common in our teens and 20s, but I know people later in life who also struggle with it. So this sounds like an opportunity to really get to know yourself separately from other people's expectations and ideas for you. Is that part of this journey?
I think so. It's a balancing act between autonomy and relatedness. Autonomy is extremely important. The first thing that the self-determination theorists such as Deci and Ryan that preceded positive psychology teach us is that we have a choice. That, to me, is one of the main findings of positive psychology. Before the positive psychology came along, positive neurobiology, the attention of the psychologist was on what goes wrong with the human condition. And how to get from being ill to being, at square one. What positive psychology is added is that we can add to life rather than to solve our problems. And that's where the CVS handbook comes in as an answer to the diagnostic and diagnostic manual of mental illnesses. It's a how-to book of human flourishing. So for me, choice is one of the main things, that we have a choice of how we feel. Certainly, our choices are constrained. I tell my class I can't dunk the basketball, so I can't decide to do that. But nevertheless, we are not helpless, as perhaps some of the psychology before the beginning of the 21st century sort of emphasized all of the things that constrain us. The positive psychology emphasizes that we have a choice. We have a choice of deciding how we react or respond to the various challenges that come down to us. And we can build our skills, our capacities to respond rather than react, to respond appropriately. We have a choice. We don't have to be completely at the mercy of what's happened to us in the past, or our genes, or our, the hormones that flowing. We have a choice. That, if nothing else, I'll tell my students, realize you have a choice, and you take responsibility for that choice. And that is, for me, the key to beginning this journey to discover happiness.
And I have tweeted out a link to Martin Seligman's website if you're looking for. He has many questionnaires that you can take in this journey of self-discovery. I'm talking with Benjamin Honeycutt, professor in the Department of Health and Human Physiology at the University of Iowa, and Gary Goody, associate professor of applied human sciences at the University of Northern Iowa. And we're talking about happiness and how to pursue it this hour. And Gary, you have mentioned flow a couple of times. So for people, I think it's a phrase that we've heard probably a lot. Most recently in the Disney movie Soul, they talked about the flow state quite a bit in that movie. But for people who aren't familiar with the term, what does it mean?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Charity. Flow is a term that was coined by my mentor and collaborator, Mike Csikszentmihalyi, many years ago now, to describe that universal experience of that deep enjoyment that can come from engaging in a challenging task that you absolutely love and for its own sake, not because you need any extrinsic motivators to do it, but you love it for its own sake. And you want to continue to do it, even though it's difficult, even though it's challenging, because it is such a rarefied experience that comes from that complete absorption, the complete focus of your attention, of all of your attentional resources on what you're doing. And from that, you know, great things can happen. So it's not this idea of going with the flow. You know, it's really, that's, you know, become such a popular phrase in the last few years. It's really quite the opposite. You're stretching yourself to do something that is difficult and worthwhile. And it's built upon this premise, and there's a lot of good research now to support this, that the best experiences in life very often come from the hard stuff, or come from being in the zone, which is the phrase as it's applied, certainly within sports. So contrary to what we're conditioned to think about, you know, challenges, or, you know, facing challenges or challenges being difficult, challenges can actually be, if you do it right, and if you have this framework that you're working from, can really be exhilarating, can really provide a deep sense of enjoyment. So it really is what we're doing when we're feeling most fully alive. When we do it, we feel in harmony with the environment around us. We do it quite naturally when we sing, when we dance, in sports, but it can also happen at work. It can happen when you read a good book. It can happen in school. Our research shows that it doesn't happen there nearly as much as it should. It can happen when you have a good conversation. And I'll just quickly here mention, just to give people a more complete thumbnail of what's going on during a state of flow, and we can take some questions if there are some. Attention is something that's often underrated. When you hear people talk about flow in the popular culture, you know, they talk about this exciting state and this ecstasy and all of that, and that's fine, but that I don't think is really where the gold is buried. I don't think that's really where we get the most gains. Flow is the state of complete attention on a very limited stimulus field. And that's more and more difficult, you know, in our culture today, because we're being bombarded with all of this stimuli from so many different directions. There's this freedom from worry about failure because your sense of control is strong. You know that you understand this task, how to engage in this skill that you're doing, whether it's playing a piece of music, whether it's writing a paper, whether it's delivering a speech, whether it's dancing, you know, with an ensemble, your self-consciousness disappears, or as Mike has often put it, the ego falls away. The sense of time becomes distorted, as I mentioned earlier. Very often hours will pass, you know, and it'll feel as if they're minutes. And something that's intriguing, and it really makes this work, is that the experience becomes what we call autotelic. It becomes an end in and of itself. You don't need to be extrinsically motivated. You just want to do it because of the work itself, the activity itself is something that, you know, is satisfying. And there are a few things that are necessary for the flow to happen. One is very clear goals at the time that you're doing it. Because having very clear goals when you're moving from one micro goal to another really orders and clarifies our thinking so that we're able to focus exclusively on what we're doing. One is immediate feedback. You know how you're doing, what you're doing, you know it so well, so that when you mess up, you immediately know. When you did it well, and you can self-correct. And if you did it well, it's like, yeah, I got it. I did that right. So there's this immediate feedback that comes from, not necessarily from an external source that's, you know, applauding when you've done a great job, although that can certainly be present and can be important, but it's more so the immediate feedback that comes from you're performing the task or the work itself that you know so well. And then the last thing is the balance between your perceived level of skill to do the task and the opportunity or the challenge required of you to do it.
We're going to have to finish that thought in just a moment, Gary. Gary Goody, Associate Professor of Applied Human Sciences at the University of Northern Iowa. We've been talking about flow. We'll continue in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa.
The way you get your news may have changed during this pandemic, but you still need to know what's going on in our state every day. IPR News has you covered. Subscribe to our new podcast, Here First, and start your day equipped with the essential local news you need to know, delivered in under 15 minutes, weekdays by 7 a.m. Get analysis from IPR's team of reporters. Learn about what's going on at the State House and on the ground in your community. Subscribe to Here First today, wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about happiness and what science can tell us about what makes us happy, how we can harness that knowledge in our own pursuit of happiness. With me this hour, Gary Goody. He's Associate Professor of Applied Human Sciences at the University of Northern Iowa. He teaches a course called Foundations of Positive Psychology, the Science of Human Flourishing. I'm also talking with Benjamin Honeycutt, a professor in the Department of Health and Human Physiology at the University of Iowa. He's teaching a course called Health for Happiness, and you are welcome to join the conversation with your experiences, your questions. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can email talkofiowa at iowapublicradio.org or tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. And Gary, just before the break, we were talking about flow, and you were sharing with us some of the different elements of flow. And I think that this is one of those, again, it's an amorphous kind of definition. I think those of us who have achieved flow state probably recognize what you're saying, just kind of like people who experience a runner's high know what you're talking about. People who've never experienced a runner's high get really frustrated when runners talk about that. So when you're talking about a flow state, if that's not something that you've necessarily felt, do you have a shortcut to try to help people understand what they're going for?
So first of all, sorry that I was going on and on there and didn't know that we had a break coming up. I have this bad echo in my headphones.
Gary, would it help to switch to your phone so you don't have to deal with that echo?
Hey, we could try that.
Yeah,
let's go ahead and do that.
Let's go ahead and do that. And all right, so we'll put you on hold for just a moment. We'll be back with Gary in just a second. And as we wait for Gary to come back, we'll explore the flow state a little bit more. But Ben, we have this question from Libet. I find my happiness sensation is closely related to feeling good physically. Can you address happiness in those who are struggling with a physical inability? Tell me about how our physical health and how we feel might relate to happiness and how to deal with that.
Oh, gosh. Of course, there are constraints to our happiness. We live in the real world. I think I'll point to Carl Rogers and to the research that's been done about resilience, build our capacity to deal with the difficulties that come down to us through life. There was no way to avoid the problems and the misfortunes and the pains that come to us, but we can build a resilience, a habitual way of handling with equanimity, with patience, with care. The Carl Rogers and the psychologist that you read about, who write about resilience, remind me a lot of Marcus Aurelius, the Stoic philosophers of the Roman period. But there's something to be said about building that capacity to deal with the misfortunes of life. And you're not going to avoid them. And part of the solution to, or the direction toward flourishing, is that ability to deal with all of the trials and tribulations that face us, not get, you know, thrown off base and become rigid or unable to act or panic-stricken, but to be able to have that ability. And, of course, is what I try to teach my students, that to aim in that direction of resilience. That, I think, is one of the best recipes that positive psychology has given us.
Well, and I can imagine that is resonating in a way that it has never resonated before after this pandemic year. I think those of us who have experienced resilience, who are resilient, have moved forward in a happier way. And that's not to criticize anybody who would be really, really struggling in this pandemic. It's been so difficult and so hard, and there are some situations that are just almost impossible to overcome. But resilience is key right here, isn't it, Ben?
I think so. And that's the trouble with happiness. You really can't use that word happy to describe resilience. Resilience is this ability. This ability to go forward with hope, with confidence that I things are going to come and I can handle them. And I think, again, as you say, this last year has shown me the value of being resilient, of being able to cope with a fairly difficult situation. It's been over a year.
Yeah. We do have Gary on the telephone now. So, Gary, let's get back to our conversation about flow state. And we've got a caller who wants to jump into that conversation, too. But as I was saying earlier, for people who haven't necessarily experienced it, when you talk about it, I can imagine that can be really frustrating. Do you have a shortcut to help people understand what you're talking about if it's not something that they've experienced themselves?
Well, thank you, Charity. Sorry about that issue there, but this should work now. So no echo. That's great. So I don't know about a shortcut, but I can offer some thoughts here. Part of what we've learned about flow and what makes flow so powerful comes from a framework from the world of physics, of all places, and that is this concept of entropy that I'm sure many of the listeners are aware of, you know, which argues that highly ordered systems over time become disorganized, become disordered, and leak energy. And that's certainly true in our lives. Our cognitive system, back to this idea of attention, very often and very easily, especially in the world in which we live right now, leaks energy because we've got, rather than being able to focus with all of our attention on what we're doing at the time, completely engaging in it, we're being bombarded by all of the stimuli and all of these screens and all of these messages and all of the stuff that's taxing our attention. So one thing that I could say is that we can do is we can limit our working memory. When you're working on something, when you're working on a task, when you're working on a hobby, something that interests you, you've heard this advice before, turn off your phone, shut off the screens, unless that's what you need to do this, so that your experience isn't mediated by all of this artificial stuff that's getting in the way from your having as much of a, you know, pure experience with whatever you're doing at the time. That's going to help keep your attention focused. The other is limit task switching so that your cognitive system isn't leaking because you're jumping from one task to the other, but really building this sense of achievement by immersing yourself in something for an extended period of time, where there's this balance of, I started to say earlier, between your challenges, that are required of you to be successful at it and your level of skill at doing it. You had on your show a few weeks ago, Cal Newport, I believe, the author of Deep Work and a number of other more recent books. And one of the things that Cal is very big on is, I think it's tremendously important, is this idea of time blocking, to block out chunks of your day, at least an hour long, maybe even a couple of hours, where you're committed to working exclusively on whatever that task is at that time. That kind of structuring of your time so that you can focus your cognitive power, focus your energy just on what you're doing then, is a great way to help to at least start, if you're not familiar with flow, to have some sense of what this experience is about. Because it's not going to happen when we're dividing ourselves among, you know, 20 different distractors at the same time.
All right. Multitasking may be the enemy of flow. Tina is on the line in Hastings. Hi, Tina.
Hi. How are you, Charity?
Good. What would you like to talk about?
Well, first of all, I want to say thanks for the insights both on flow and on signature strength. And I feel like it takes courage to be self-aware of one's signature strengths and getting more competent in that. But I'm curious as to how would you teach your child to pursue flow professionally? You know, I know from personal experience, I'm a creative artist, an educator, teacher, and I've always at the core somehow incorporated into my job my passion for communication and storytelling, but I always was doing that on the side, and I had this fear of failure, this fear of finances, but finally the pandemic kind of said, hey, let go of that and just do it. How can I gently encourage my son, who's 11 right now, to do the same, to find flow in a future job, but do it a little quicker than I did at age 45?
That is such a great question, Tina. And Gary, I mean, first of all, I feel like little kids just have flow sort of built into how they live their daily lives. But it does feel like we lose that as we age out of toddlerdom and those early years. So what do you think? How can Tina help her child really discover this kind of experience?
Yeah, I think you're right, Charity, that children seem to be able to find flow quite easily because they're learning, they're developing new skills, they're meeting those challenges, they're getting great joy out of it. Play, as Ben will be able to tell you, is a tremendous vehicle for making that happen. But the trajectory for us as we go into adulthood seems to be more from flow to stuck. And hopefully we can get back to flow again. So it's at least flow, stuck, flow, rather than just flow, stuck, and that's where you are. But Tina, I'm glad you brought this up because flow is something that is at heart developmental. We have this term, flow state, as if it's something you can just kind of turn on like a switch. And it doesn't work that way. It's something that we develop over time by becoming really competent, by becoming really good at something that we really love. And the critical thing, I like the fact that you use the term gently for doing it with your 11-year-old son, is finding opportunities for him to explore, to try out new things, to try out new skills, to try out new hobbies, and see where it goes. You know, he may find that some things really click that really work for him, and there are some things that just aren't right. And the things that really click, you know, encourage him to keep pursuing that. I know that sounds like simple advice, but it's when we're able to find these, find something that really does it for us, that really helps, you know, the world around us come together and we really feel in harmony with it, that great things can happen. But he will find it. I'm confident of that. Back to Charity's question earlier about finding your passion. I think the line is, or should be, rather than find your passion, find your flow. So find what it is that really does it for him and encourage him to continue doing that and building his challenges required of him to get a little better and up his skill to match that and improve up his challenge and up his skill and turn him loose.
Well, and recognizing that his flow may not necessarily be the thing that you really want him to be pursuing,
that's
but we all
true
have
as well.
our different
that's,
things. That's tough as a parent. And
that's right.
Actually, we have another developmental question here. Ben, I'll let you take a crack at this. And I know brain development is probably not really your area of study, but Laura in Davenport has this question. How does brain development impact ability to choose happiness, especially relating to adolescents and teens? And we do see those just enormous mood swings in teens and really their inability to maybe necessarily understand what they're feeling and control their emotions in the way that we learn to as we age. What are your thoughts on that, Ben?
I've got a lot of thoughts. I'm not sure I can communicate them in the time we have. Play, that for me is a way in which children develop. And as adults, we develop that way as well. The neurobiologists have recently written a lot about neuroplasticity. Even though we're getting old and we're losing brain cells all along, nevertheless, we have the capacity to build new pathways in the brain, new neurons, neuroplasticity is great hope for us. Even though we're getting older, we can still continue. The mind can change the brain. So the developmental process for children as well as adults with neuroplasticity, I think, benefits by play. The play is an emotion. Recently discovered, is one of the basic emotions, Panksepp says. It's an emotion that allows us to develop new ways of dealing with the world, to explore, to experiment with different ways of dealing with other people, to control our emotions. In play, we become angry, but within that play feel, within that play form, we're able to control. So for me, play is the answer. It's a way of building from below, not from above by telling people what they should be doing, but through experiences. The joyful experience of playing for me is an invaluable way to develop. Of course, it needs to be guided play, I suppose, but the play has a lot of potential that's been unrealized until recently with people like Seligman and others, Dan Siegel, and others who developed this field in psychology.
Well, we only have about 2 minutes left, which seems heartbreaking at this point. And I think both of you should come back. We should talk about happiness in a couple of different ways over the next few months. I think that would be wonderful. And we have a lot of people with questions who I think would enjoy that as well. But with only about a minute left each, I mean, Ben, we've talked about identifying our strengths and really getting to know ourselves. That can be a key toward moving toward happiness. You've talked about play. What other advice would you have for somebody who's thinking, I want to be a happier person? Where do I go?
I think what I'm going to close my class with transcendence, one of the virtues that come to us from the wisdom of the past, transcendent spirituality. I'm going to have my class read Rudolf Otto's Idea of the Holy. The experience of the numinous, that reality, the mystery at the heart of all being, the mysterium tremendum, the experience of that reality as a presence, and a flow experience indeed that's available to us all, but we don't develop it. I'm going to challenge my students, and I'd like to challenge the listeners, transcendence, the numinous, the experience of that larger reality of which we're a part, a minuscule part, is for me one of the highlights of happiness, of living a good life. So I want to point in that direction for my last minute.
All right. Well, Benjamin Honeycutt, professor in the Department of Health and Human Physiology at the University of Iowa, author of The Age of Experiences, Harnessing Happiness to Build a New Economy. Thank you so much. And Gary, you've got 30 seconds. What would you like to add? And I know I'll mention the flowchannel.com if people are interested in learning more about the flow state. But leave us with one short thought.
Yeah, I would say, going back to Seligman's work about building three different types of lives or happiness, the pleasant life, which is oftentimes what we think about when we talk about happiness, which is more of a hedonic kind of happiness. But better than that is building an engaged life where you're marshaling your strengths and your talents, being good at something. And I think flow is a great vehicle for doing that. And then beyond that, building a meaningful life, using your skills and talents to serve a higher purpose, focusing your attention on something, you know, bigger than yourself.
All right. Well, Gary, we are out of time, but thank you so much, Gary Goody of the University of Northern Iowa. Again, theflowchannel.com is where you can find out more about the flow state. This is Talk of Iowa.